Well, this lecture is on value, utility, and price. And really, we wish to entertain two different topics. One is valuation, which you've already heard a bit about with Professor Salerno's lecture on marginal utility and revolution. And the other is the question of appraisement. And what we'll argue is that valuation is the procedure that we as individual persons use to economize our action, to determine, in other words, what the highest valued ends are to pursue and how to pursue these ends in the least cost manner. Then the second task, so we wish to just delineate this, the nature of valuation. The second task then is to talk about how valuation is inadequate for making economizing decisions within the division of labor. Now, we cannot, in fact, simply rely upon our own mental judgments of value to determine how to allocate factors of production across a specialized economy. There, we have to have arithmetic computation. We have to have a method that's objective in the sense that we can use cardinal numbers in order to make judgments of the value of ends that we aim at and the cost of the means that we employ. Now, appraisement will actually have its own lecture later today. Dr. Salerno will give a lecture on economic calculation and talk in detail about appraisement. What we wish to do with the subject of appraisement is simply to show the link between valuation and appraisement. Now, to begin, let's just review some basic points about human action. As Dr. Holtzman pointed out last night, all economic thought begins with the concept of human action. Human action defined as purposeful behavior. That is to say, in human action, we're motivated to attain an end. And it's precisely the value that we attach to this end that drives us to act. When we act, of course, it's not simply that we formulate in our minds an end to pursue, but that we recognize in the world that there are means that can aid us in the attainment of our end. And so we say action is applying means or employing means to the attainment of ends. We begin with a fundamental axiom of economics, that human action exists. This fundamental axiom is self-evidently true in the Aristotelian sense. That is to say, in order to make any attempt to prove that this axiom is false, one must assume that it is true. Any attempt to demonstrate that the proposition human action exists is false is a human action that has the end of such a demonstration and would employ means designed to attain that end. So we can begin our discussion of economic thought on very solid philosophical, realistic grounds. Now, the second dimension of this that Professor Holtzman talked about last night, the second dimension of the concept of human action and this notion that human action exists, is reflective knowledge that we have about action. And as he pointed out, all of our understanding of human action depends upon our being able to reflect upon our own action, to think about, in other words, and contemplate the meaning of our own actions. This is where we come up with the concepts that are basic in economic thought, the concept of an end, concept of means, the concept of success in action or failure. And all of the other basic conceptual structure of action. Now, with that as background, let's just begin a delineation of the propositions that relate to valuation. The first thing we want to point out is that as we reflectively think about action, we notice that action is the product only of individual persons. Only individual human beings, in other words, engage in human action. There's neither action of non-human entities, or at least subhuman entities, nor could there be action of, more important for our purposes, collective beings. So we must rule out immediately the notion that we can have a collective acting agent. The reason this is important is because if this is true, then it follows that we cannot directly have something like collective valuation. We can't appeal to the solution of the problem that I mentioned at the beginning of determining how to allocate factors in society of a division of labor by appealing to something like a collective agent of valuing. This we must forego. And instead, we must recognize that there's a problem that has to be faced in addressing this question of economizing the division of labor, which is how do we reconcile the different valuations of different individuals so that the group gets the highest valued uses of the means, the highest valued ends are satisfied to the exclusion of the lesser valued. And again, as I suggested, this is done by and can only be done by appraisement. Now, another basic proposition that we want to entertain is, of course, the scarcity of means. We know that means are scarce because action exists. The existence of action presupposes an unmet end, an unattained end. But if means were superabundant, all of our ends would be attained. And therefore, the mere fact that we act implies scarcity. Now, if means are scarce, then obviously, when we act, we must make a choice between the end that we pursue and the end that we forego. So here we hit upon the basic principle that leads us to our discussion of valuation, and that is choice. If we were incapable of choosing in the face of scarce means, then we could not act at all. We would just be dumbfounded with the problem of trying to select from the various possible courses of action what we could do. If human action exists, then obviously we've made choices. And we've chosen, as we'll argue in a minute, those things that we value more. Choice, furthermore, is two-dimensional. We not only choose the option that we aim at, but we simultaneously then choose an alternative that we forego. So if we're choosing on the basis of value, then obviously every action has a value and a cost. The value of what we strive for and the value of what we forego. Choice is done by valuation precisely because human action is purposeful. As long as we're aiming to attain an end that we find beneficial or valuable, we say that this is a purposeful act. It simply implies value, or to put it differently, that's just what we mean by value. Now, choice, then, in valuation implies a comparison of values. So we simply compare the value of one course of action with the value of another course of action, saying one is more valuable and another is less valuable. This, then, is the principle of preference. So preference, we can say, is an ordinal rank between two valuations that are made. Again, the value of what we pursue in action and the value of what we forego. Furthermore, this preference is bound up in the action. Preference is part of the action that we take. Preference is the state of mind or the judgment that we make in our mind of the alternatives of action at the moment we decide to act. It's important to drive this point home because mainstream economists tend to see valuation as a map of utility that somehow imposes a particular choice pattern upon us. It's something like a separate, an apart from the human person that is manifested somehow in our action. Whereas the more realistic view is, again, that preference is in the action. Preference is a part of the action. This thing is preference separate from action. But preference is simply the state of mind that we have when we act. Preferences then obviously are not constant. We can't think of a preference map being demonstrated over time by our actions, as in Samuelson's principle of revealed preference, let's say, where we just watch what a person does over the week and we see the preference map being exposed by the various actions. We do, of course, have the principle of demonstrated preference. That is, since preference is bound up in action, we can infer what a person's preference was when that person acts. We can infer that that action was, in fact, preferred to the alternative And that's why the person acted in that way as opposed to another. But we need, again, to avoid the error of thinking that preferences somehow, again, exist separate from action and impose themselves on the individual. The individual is something like a mere cipher through which preferences work. Our view, again, is, we think, more realistic. The human person is an integral unit, and preference is part of, in fact, preference is the dominant part of acting. Now, another point that we wish to make about value is this very important point that value is subjective. By subjective, we just mean that value is an intensive state of mind. That is to say, value has no extensive property outside of the human mind. And because it has no extensive property, it cannot be objectively observed by different persons. And so this is all that we mean by subjective. Value simply lacks an extensive objective property. Now, certain things follow from this, of course. The most important is that value cannot be measured. This is because we cannot define a unit of value. We cannot define a unit of value because value is simply a state of mind. It's just a judgment of our mind that we make. And since the judgment in my mind is wholly in my mind and not observable to you, no unit of value could ever be defined for this state of mind. In fact, to think that value could be cardinalized, we could have cardinal numbers that apply to value, is to make a fundamental error. it's to suppose that value is a substance. Like value is the amount of water in a bathtub, right, that we can measure in gallons or some such thing. It's even wrong to think that value is like water in a bathtub that we can't measure in gallons for some reason, but we can measure the level of it. The Austrian view is completely different. Value is simply nothing more than the state of mind that we have. And as a state of mind, it's fundamentally impossible to engage in any kind of quantitative analysis of value. So we have no cardinal units of value. We have, it would follow, of course, no arithmetic operations. You can't add and subtract values or perform any other arithmetic computations with values. Now, another aspect of value we mentioned previously that we want to interject here, because oftentimes these two principles are confused or conflated, I guess is a better word. This is what I mentioned before, that value is not constant. We realize this again by reflection. We know that our valuations don't stay constant, or to be perhaps a little more rigorous with the proof, we know our valuations are not constant in some fundamental sense, because by reflection we understand the principle of regret. When we regret an action in the past, we regret it only because we recognize that it would have been possible for us to have acted differently. But if it's possible for us to have acted differently, to have chosen differently, in other words, then our preferences are not constant. In other words, there isn't something like a constant quantitative relationship between the world, things that exist in the world, and our actions. When things that exist in the world affect our actions, they do so through our mental judgments. And so preferences, in a sense, then dominate these external objective factors of our action. Right? Only if there was some constant relationship between the two, that is, if our preferences were just, again, reducing the human person to a cipher, so that certain external factors always produce the exact same response in us, the same action, would we be free to make this kind of assumption? Notice, if we were to make this assumption that there was a fixed quantitative relationship between our preferences and the external world, then, of course, it would be possible to have mathematical representations of not only of utility, well, at least of action, and perhaps of utility itself. The subjectiveness of utility would not prevent us from having formulistic expressions of our actions. But this, again, is what we're denying, right? We deny this because on reflection, we understand that this principle, this fixed quantitative nature of our preferences is false. So we reject at the outset any mathematical functions of demand or utility. And we want to go a little bit further and delineate this argument and direct it toward the standard presentation in the neoclassical economists on the question of utility. And first, let's start with what we might call representation theory. Here the argument, and this again would be a neoclassical treatment. And the argument would be something like this. Let's say that we have a rank order. Let's say these are grades, A, B, and C. And this is just an ordinal rank, right? If you get a grade of A, it's a higher grade than grade of B, B higher than C. And the argument would go like this. Well, if we have an ordinal rank system like this, then we can just represent this ordinal rank by a numeric counterpart. We can just pick any numbers we want. And that would be a representation of the ordinal rank. And since it represents the ordinal rank, it's not the same thing as the ordinal rank, but it's a representative of it. We can then use we can have a mathematical treatment of utility. We could have a function here and describe how we get these numbers given various inputs that create the result of A, B, and C. Now remember, we've already dealt with a fundamental problem here. The fundamental problem is that A, B, and C are not, in economic reasoning, are not grades. These are not objective outcomes, as I'm suggesting in my example. But they're states of mind. This may seem plausible, right, if we say that A, B, and C are something like objective results, and therefore we give a quantitative representation. But that's, in fact, not what's being done. A, B, and C in utility are nothing more than states of mind. And so we have this fundamental problem that we've discussed already. But let's waive that for the moment, and discuss whether or not it's possible, even if we say that utility is like like level of water in a bathtub. It's a quantitative thing that we can definitely say, here is a higher level, here is a middle level, here is a lower level. Whether or not that can be represented by a cardinal number system. Now, I might point out that there was a debate in the economics literature about this question that occurred in the 1920s and 30s. And in a sense, my presentation is just following that debate. And so those who are arguing against having cardinal representations of utility, against this project, argued this way. They said, this to have cardinal numbers on the right-hand side here representing the ordinal rank adds a condition that does not exist in the ordinal rank itself. And so it isn't a representation. Right? The cardinal numbers are more than a representation, so to speak. There's something like a representation plus another condition, which we've ruled out by the notion of saying that utility is just a rank level. This utility is greater than that utility, which is greater than another utility. So the argument was that the condition that's being employed here is the particular gap, the quantitative gap between these cardinal numbers. So why do we pick 10? Wouldn't it also be fine to have a representation where we picked a different set of numbers with a different gap size? Well, sure, right? I mean, we could pick as long as the A number was bigger than the B number, which was bigger than the C number. Any set of numbers would do. And so the counter argument by those who favor cardinal utility was linear transformation. So they said, well, we can change these gap sizes. That's not a problem. All we have to do is take our original function and multiply it or divide it by a fixed number, right? We multiply all these numbers by 2, and we get 190 and 170 and 150, right? Now we have 20, a gap size of 20. Or we can cut all the numbers in half. And so we have 47.5 and 42.5. 37.5. So now we've cut the gap sizes in half. But linear transformations don't change the basic function, right? And so one function really does represent all of these gap sizes. This was the counter argument. Now, the final rebuttal, as I already implicitly stated, was simply to point out that while the linear transformation changes the gap sizes, it does so proportionally, whereas the ordinal rank actually would be consistent with any particular number scheme, like, let's say, 100, 95, and 72. That would work, too. So the answer to this, then, the final answer, and this line of reasoning was then abandoned by those who wanted to establish cardinal utility on the grounds of this answer, was that one single ordinal rank can only be represented by every and all linear functions, right? And therefore, it's useless to say we can just pick any one linear function and proceed as if this is a representation of an ordinal rank. Okay, so what was suggested after that attempt was the technique of indifference curve analysis. And indifference curve analysis, as some of you may be aware, argues in the following fashion, that while it's possible to establish preference, and no one argues that it isn't in economic thought, it's also possible for individuals to be indifferent between two options. And if this is so, then indifference can provide us the, if you will, backdoor into cardinal representation. If we assume this, that when a person is indifferent between two options, this means equal utility. That, of course, is a rather large assumption that, once again, we would have to reject on the grounds that we spoke about before. That is to say, if a person were really indifferent, that is, couldn't choose between two options, this simply means that his judgment of value is such that he's not making a choice. It says nothing about whether utility in some cardinal sense is equal or not. It just doesn't answer this question. Right? But anyway, we'll proceed to develop indifference curve analysis briefly, at least, and point out some of the other problems that exist. And we can do this just by thinking of what a preference rank might look like for demand analysis. And we'll get to this at the later part of the lecture. But most of you are familiar with this. Let's say we have some unit of a good, let's say an X unit, and a person has a preference rank that looks like this. So that if the price of a unit of X happened to be $80, this person would be willing to exchange to buy the unit, right, because he prefers the unit to $80. But if the price happened to be $100, he would not exchange. He would refuse and keep his money, which he values more than the unit. And so this is the way, of course, we proceed in the Austrian view to derive demand. Again, we'll show how this is done in detail in a minute. The critical point that we want to make here is that this procedure requires or notices the reality of the comparison of the valuation between the unit of the good and money. We buy things, that's what we do, right? We simply compare the value of what we obtain to the value of what we forego. And if it's a monetary exchange, then we're comparing the value of money to the value of the good. And this is how our demand then is set or determined. Now, let's compare this to the approach of indifference curves. Let's say we have a utility ranking. So let's say we take an indifference curve approach and we map out a utility function. And we just take a few of the rankings of utility to illustrate this. And let's say that the rankings usually look something like this. So we say there's a bundle of goods that are ranked, right? X and Y, let's say two units of X and one of Y. That has a certain value that's ranked in preference, let's say, above another combination, 1X and 1Y. And then maybe we could even say that 0x and 1y would have a rank order lower than that. But this seems obvious. I'm taking obvious cases. There might be other instances where the rank order is the same. This would be the indifference case, right? Maybe we have 1x and 2y. Let me just write it there on the same rank level. Okay? So we can do all this. So this is the preference. This is the indifference. Whereas Austrians would exclude indifference precisely because it can never be part of action. But here I want to make a different point. And the point, notice, is, we can say it this way, is that this utility analysis or indifference curve analysis artificially bifurcates the elements of choice. In other words, it says something entirely different from this. It says that what we do is map out our utility of goods against goods, of different bundles of goods or units of goods against other bundles of those goods. We're comparing, in other words, you know, bundles of apples and oranges with different combinations of apples and oranges. Where's money, then, in this analysis? And the answer is, of course, in this kind of analysis, we never value money. When you add the budget constraint, in order to see, you know, where you, on that budget constraint, attain the highest or furthest from the origin to the right indifference curve, you never value money. All you do, of course, is attempt to reach the highest indifference curve by minimizing your monetary expenditure. But money is never valued in this system. And again, this is completely unrealistic, right? Whatever else could be said about it, this is not a realistic approach. The realistic approach is, as we said before, what we actually do, which is we value goods against money. Notice it's because the neoclassical economists proceed in this way that they think they can treat money as a veil. Right? What's really being determined then are barter exchange ratios between goods. But as Mises pointed out in The Theory of Money and Credit in 1912, things change entirely when we have a monetary economy. Because the option of exchanging things for money is an entirely new option. It does not exist in a barter world. And therefore, it changes all of our demands, right? All of our demands are different because there is money than they would be in a barter world. And therefore, we have something that Mises called the non-neutrality of money. If we take money out of the picture, we get an entirely different matrix of prices. Money can't be a veil. And even at the micro level, we see that this mistake, as we would term it, is being made. Now, a second problem with indifference curve analysis is that indifference curve analysis, as you, those of you who study it know, requires a complete ranking of all possible bundles. In other words, the person has to be able to map out the entire indifference map in order to proceed and to, you know, find the maximum utility point. Now, this is clearly impossible. No single person could weigh off all of the different options of choice and come up with a valuation in his mind at some moment of choice, incorporating all of these different valuations. The problem is just too complex. And most neoclassical economists will admit this. In other words, they'll say at this point that what now the utility analysis is being applied to are economic agents, not human persons, not acting beings, but these fictitious economic agents. And then, as Dr. Holtzman pointed out last night, if this is the way you proceed, then you have the problem of application to the real world. If your theory is just about economic agents, then what relevance does it have to the real world? How do you apply it? How do we know that it can be made applicable to the real world? So this problem, again, doesn't exist in the Austrian framework. A third point against indifference analysis is that indifference, as we mentioned in the definition of the term, implies the absence of choice. If we're indifferent between options, I mean, definitionally, it means we're not choosing between them. But if we're not choosing between them, then we're not acting toward them. We're acting towards something else that we are choosing. And therefore, indifference could never be the basis for a theory of action. It could only be the basis for a theory of inaction, or non-action. If we were indifferent all around to every option, in other words, we would never act. Now, indifference, we might put the case in a somewhat different way. Surely the concept of indifference is a useful psychological concept, or phimological, as Mises calls it. In other words, in our everyday affairs, we know that, in fact, we are indifferent sometimes. We don't want to choose. In other words, we don't choose between these two options just because they seem to be of the same value to us. We have no basis upon which to choose between them. Entrepreneurs would be very interested in this question because they're interested more in phimology, in the psychological aspects of action and in history and in the future. Actual concrete actions than they are these categorical, formal presentations of theory. So, in Austrian circles, we freely admit that there's something like indifference, that we're indifferent between options, but we recognize that this is simply not an economic theoretical concept. It's not a useful theoretical concept. It's a useful practical concept. Useful for doing history, it's useful for doing entrepreneurial forecasts and so on. The intensity of the preference that people have for things is important. In economic theory, it doesn't matter at all. All that matters is that a person has a preference, because that's what's necessary for action to be forthcoming. Now, we might notice another point. Hinted at this before. All economists are eager to avoid the explicit assumption of cardinal utility. Again, since the 1930s, this has been accepted throughout the mainstream. And yet they wish to use what is essentially a cardinal utility analysis. This is indifference curve or utility functions and so on. Indifference then can be seen as simply a equivocation that permits this, right? So we say, well, we know that people are indifferent sometimes. You're indifferent sometimes. I'm indifferent. It's perfectly reasonable to think that we're indifferent. But it's an entirely different thing to say what they say, and again, this assumption is always implicit, that indifference means equal utility. That's entirely different, right? If valuations are simply our states of mind, then they're never equal. There's no such thing as equal because there's no units in which we can express our value. And therefore, there's no sense in which we can say they're equal. Once we admit that we can, in fact, say that they're equal, we get equal utility from a situation of indifference, then cardinal utility comes in the back door. If there's equal utility, there must be units of utility. And if they're units of utility, then these must be attachable to instances of preference as well as indifference. So it's one thing just to say we're indifferent. It's entirely different to accept indifference as the basis of cardinal utility. Now, we might notice just a few other points about indifference, weaknesses, we might say. And I'm speaking to those who've gone through this kind of analysis. you know that when you map out an indifference map and you use it to derive demand curves, that in order to do this, in order to have unique demand curves, it must be the case that the utility map is continuous. If continuous, smooth indifference curves, right? Otherwise, the tangency points on the budget constraint will not be unique. If you had sharp points, right, you'd be able to twist the budget constraint around that point without changing the choice. You'd have many prices at which you'd buy the same quantities and so on. And you wouldn't get a nice smooth demand curve. But continuity isn't implied in indifference. Right? Continuity is an additional assumption. Why should we think that our preferences, our utilities, are continuous? And of course, continuity rests upon the implicit assumption of infinitesimal units. Now we not only have cardinal units of utility, we have infinitesimally small units of utility. And again, how far do we wish to go down this road? It seems to be tremendous kind of exaggeration beyond realism just to get a demand curve. And then we might also notice that In the neoclassical tradition, it's typical to treat demand curves as empirical. This wouldn't necessarily be so, but it's a rather standard approach. That is to say, a demand curve is a hypothesis that could be tested by empirical data over time. Card and Krugman's famous study on minimum wages is an example. So this sort of view is rather rampant in the mainstream, although it isn't theoretically necessary to make this kind of application. But if you do, then of course there's another assumption that you've added into the mix if you base demand curves on utility theory, which is that utility is constant. In other words, the whole entire utility map must stay constant over time. And then you really do, just like Samuelson said, map out demand over time by seeing how a person acts in these different external conditions with the same exact preference map in his mind. Prices of goods change and incomes change and so on. And we just map out the demand curve. If you don't assume that the utility map itself is constant, if the indifference curves can shift from one buying moment to the next, from today to tomorrow to the next day, then of course you don't get demand curves at all. Right? You have shifting points on different demand curves. Let's say your preference for a good just simply goes up, and so your indifference curve shifts out to the right. Then if you buy more of the good at a higher price, that's not on the same demand curve as buying the lower amount of good at a lower price today. Okay, now let me just go on to mention a few more points that we want to take in transition to this question of appraisement. And let's return to the notion of cost that I mentioned before. Remember, we said that in choice, we always aim at what we value more, and we set aside the pursuit of what we value less. And so the cost of our action is that alternative foregone, the value of this best foregone alternative. So in every action, we have what rules that action is an opportunity cost. This then must be incorporated into all economic action, all analyses of action. Now, additionally, then it would follow that in every action we aim our action at what Mises and Rothbard called psychic profit. As we always anticipate when we choose to act that the value of the course of action we choose will be greater than the value of the course of action that we forego. Otherwise, again, action would not be purposeful; it would be inexplicable on the grounds of what we know human behavior to be. It's also true, of course, that we can assess after the fact whether or not this profit accrued. So it's possible to do both entrepreneurial calculations of profit before we act and what we might call accounting calculations of profit after we act. We can reassess our action. And then finally, let me repeat this principle that I mentioned before about economizing. This is, in a way, just a different restatement of the notion of psychic profit. When we say that we economize, it means that with a given means, we aim at the highest valued end, the thing that we prefer most. Or to attain a given end, we strive to do so with the least cost means. So all action is economizing. And as we engage in individual action, we're able to do this just on the basis of our own mental judgments. Our mental judgments are sufficient to make valuations of the alternative courses of action, of the factors that we use in alternative uses so that we can determine least cost, and to compare these valuations so that we can say, yes, when I act in this way, the value of my action will exceed the cost of my action, and so I decide to do this. So all of these sorts of decisions by the human person can be made on the basis of valuation. Now, let's try to translate this valuation process to society and the division of labor. In the division of labor, of course, we have specialized uses of the factors of production. And so each individual, instead of producing for his own consumption, is producing for the consumption of others and then relying upon the production of other people to produce for his own consumption. And the question then arises as to whether or not we can make decisions about economizing uses of the factors of production in this division of labor on the basis of valuation. And it would seem that there would be two possibilities. And of course, what I'm rehearsing here is simply an overview of Mises's famous argument against economic calculation in socialism. The two possibilities would be that we let one person determine what the most valued goods are and the least cost means of production in his own mind. We get, in other words, one person doing the valuing. Now, the problem with this is obvious. The problem, as we suggested before, is that valuations are subjective. That is, you have your valuation in my mind, I have my valuation in my own mind, and other people's valuations are in their minds. How would it be possible for any one of us to be privy to these valuations in such a way that we could set them against each other? If I value chocolate ice cream over vanilla and you vanilla over chocolate, I'm in no position to say that my valuation of chocolate over vanilla is greater than yours for vanilla over chocolate. This is because I cannot experience your valuation. I can only experience my own. And therefore, we can't appeal to something like a dictator solution here, right? The central planner is in no position to be able to determine what the highest valued ends are to be pursued. He's blocked from this by the subjective nature of value itself. The second option would be, let's dispense with having a single person do this. Let's just do it among ourselves. Why can't we do that? But again, it should be obvious to you that we're simply blocked by the subjective nature of value in doing this. Right? As I already suggested with my example, we simply cannot come to any objective agreement as to whether or not the value I have for the chocolate ice cream exceeds or is less than the value that you have for vanilla. We could compromise, right? We could cajole each other and eventually, you might win out because you're bigger and stronger or something than I am. But that's not what we have in mind, right? That's not an assessment of the true value of things that we might or might not produce in the division of labor. Well, what about on the cost side? Again, we have two options. We can let one person do this, the central planner, determine what the least cost arrangements are of the factors of production. And he can do this all, allegedly, he would strive to do this all just with his own mental judgments of value. But here again, remember, the principle of opportunity cost doesn't permit this. A genuine valuation of the cost of something in the mind of a person takes place only when the alternative foregone is a real alternative foregone. If I have to buy the chocolate ice cream cone for $2, the reason I can assess the value of the chocolate ice cream relative to the $2 is because by paying the $2, I really do forego an alternative. That's an actual live option for me that I can no longer enjoy. And therefore, I'm in a position, because I can experience that, in other words, I can withhold the $2 and do the alternative act, and therefore realize the alternative value, that becomes a genuine opportunity cost. But can anybody do this in the division of labor? In the division of labor, you know, like in the American economy, we have, 185 million different jobs that are performed? We have millions and upon millions of different production facilities, thousands and thousands of land sites. Now, who can actually be in a position to experience all the options foregone from acting in this way with any particular person's labor or that way, or this way with any particular production facility or that way, this way with any particular land site or that way? And the answer is no one can do this. This just far exceeds the capacity of the human person to make these kinds of mental judgments. The other option we've already pointed out, it would be just as fruitless. Let's just have all of our own individual opportunity costs assessed against each other directly. And here again, we find we're stymied. We simply can't do this. So how do we proceed? What is the manner in which we can actually engage in economizing decisions throughout the division of labor if we can't appeal to valuation? Well, here we have to appeal to a method of arithmetic computation. And just to give you a shorthand for this, we might write it this way. We have preferences. And then generate demand and supply. Demand and supply then determine the prices of goods. And so preferences are reflected in the prices of goods. So if our preferences are more intense for a good, the price of that good would be higher. If our preferences in society are less intense, then the prices of those goods would be lower. All of our preferences then are expressed, that we have for goods, are expressed for and against money. So as we suggested before in talking about indifference curve analysis, what actually solves this problem of reconciling individual valuations in society is having our preferences expressed for and against money. So we exchange things. This results then in prices. Prices then become our cardinal units that become the basis for arithmetic computation. These arithmetic computations, of course, are accounting. Net income statements, balance sheets, and so on. These statements then are necessary or permit entrepreneurs to make appraisements of what they think will be valuable uses of the factors of production, valuable lines of capital investment, and so on. Now, we wish to briefly give an account of this analysis, right? How an Austrian would proceed by showing how preferences move to the prices of goods. But in addition to this, let me just point out how we would proceed from here. We're not going to do the bottom half of this. But prices of goods then generate two things, costs for the consumers, right? So expenditures by the buyers of the good, and revenues for the entrepreneurs who have produced and are now selling these goods. Then the revenues for the entrepreneurs constrain demand for the factors. Okay, so the entrepreneurs get funding in order to buy the factors of production from the consumers. And then along with supply, of the factors, which comes from preferences, we get the prices of the factors. So the prices of the factors are derived from the demands for the goods. And coupled with the opportunity costs for the producers who are supplying the factors, we get the prices of the factors. And the prices of the factors then generate costs for the entrepreneurs, and income for the producers, that is the owners of the factors of production, the workers and landowners and so on. So we have a complete system of pricing, a complete system of monetary incentives that are provided in the market. A complete system of economic calculation can be derived from this, starting again with the revenues that are earned from the sale of the good by the entrepreneur and the costs that are generated in the factor markets as the entrepreneur buys the factors of production. Okay, but as I said, we don't want to cover all this ground, just the top portion to indicate how the Austrians show that preferences determine prices. Now we start with the two laws of utility. In other words, we now wish to say something more about preferences than simply that they're ordinal ranks of options. But there are certain laws about these preference ranks. These laws are conjectural laws. They're what-if statements or conjectures that we make about what preferences would look like if conditions of acting were different from what they are. So we know what preferences are in an action. We see somebody buy something. We know they prefer it to the price. The laws of utility tell us what would have been the case of the person's preferences, how the person would have acted then, had conditions in the world been somewhat different. Now, the other thing that we need to integrate into this discussion or another proposition that we want to make about these laws of utility is that they apply only for what Murray Rothbard has called equally serviceable units of a good. An equally serviceable unit of a good is a good that's interchangeably useful in different pursuits. So in my example, I'm going to use an example of Honda Civics. And so the condition of equal serviceability would be that one Honda Civic attains one particular end and then is interchangeably useful in attaining a different end. In other words, I can apply it to one end, let's say commuting to work, or I could apply it to another end, let's say running errands, something like this, or another end, let's say lending it out to a friend to drive, and so on, and that one unit satisfies any one end. This is the notion of equal serviceability. Okay, so if that's the case, then I could establish a preference rank of these different units. Let's call it the first Honda Civic. It's applied to the most valuable end, let's say, in my example, commuting. Now, the value then of the Honda Civic comes from the value of the end. All means have value only as they aid in the attainment of ends. And so the value that I attach to the Honda Civic is proportional to the value of the end it achieves. So it must follow that if I have a second Honda Civic, it must rank below the first. Let's say, again, this one is used for running errands. If I value this end less highly, I must then value the use of the same identical unit of the means less highly. If, in other words, I'm already satisfying my highest valued end when I have one Honda Civic, if we conjecture what would I do with a second Honda Civic and how would I value it, the answer must be I would have to apply the second unit to a less valued end, and therefore I would have to attach less value to it. And so on, right? I would have a third Honda Civic ranked in preference below the second that I just I lend out, and so on. So we have then the two laws of utility. The first law of utility, that the greater the stock of a good, the lower the value of the marginal unit. So if I have more of a good than any one unit, I value less. Precisely because that unit is getting its value from the least valued use. So if I own three Honda Civics and I crashed one of them on my way to work, then the value of any one Honda Civic would go up. Right? Precisely because now the marginal car is the second one. And I'm applying it now to a more highly valued use when my stock is diminished. So this is the law of diminishing marginal utility. The second law of utility just says that more units of a good, a larger stock of a good, is preferred to a smaller stock of a good, fewer units of a good. This again just follows by the nature of the scarcity of means. Now, of course, we're in a position just to go directly to the preference ranks that I had mentioned before that incorporate options for buying and selling. And thus demand and supply. So let's say we have this set up. Say we have a small market for Honda Civics, and we have a first buyer, buyer A, whose valuations look like this. And buyer B, whose valuations are somewhat less intense for the Honda Civic, that is relative to money. He ranks it somewhat lower. And buyer C, let's say, is the least eager of these buyers. His preferences look like that. And then, of course, it isn't necessary for us to extend these preferences down, but if we did, of course, the second Honda Civic would rank somewhere down here for each of the individuals and so on. Now, of course, we can make a conjecture about what would happen at different prices in terms of the quantity demanded. So we know, for example, if the price were $15,000, then buyer A, the most eager buyer, would want to buy. Right? He values the one unit of the Civic more than $15,000. B and C would stay out of the market. Only at lower prices would they come in. At $14,000, though, B still wouldn't trade. So we still just have one unit. But at $13,000, buyer B would buy and buyer A. And if the price fell down to $11,000, we could even bring buyer, the least eager buyer, buyer C, into the market. So we get the law of demand, right? If we notice in a market that a certain quantity of a good has been bought at a certain price, then the law of demand says this, that if the price would have been lower than it actually was, then the quantity demanded would have either been the same or more. We know this is true because the units that would be purchased that were not purchased have lower value, and therefore would only be exchanged, that is bought, if the price were lower, to compensate for the fact that the value of these units, these submarginal units, is lower. Now we can do a similar thing then for sellers. We could stratify sellers. Let's say we have seller X, who, like seller A, is the most eager seller. Seller X, notice, is willing to sell a Honda Civic if the price is $11,000. Seller Y, who's somewhat less eager, only willing to sell if the price is $13,000. And seller Z, the least eager, only willing to sell if the price is $15,000. And then we compare up the amount demanded at these various hypothetical prices with the quantity supply. So we know at $11,000, we would only have one supplied from X. The other sellers would reserve the use of the Civics. And at $12,000, we still wouldn't bring in Y, but at $13,000 we would. At $14,000 we still wouldn't bring in Z, but at $15,000 we would. So we get the law of supply. That is, if we go into a market and we see that a certain number of units was sold by traders or sellers at a certain price, then the law of supply says that if the price would have been higher, then the quantity sold would have either been the same or more. The higher price is necessary to compensate the seller for surrendering a more valuable unit. Right? As the stock of the good is reduced, the remaining units have, or any one of the remaining units has a greater value. Now, of course, we're in a position to determine the price. And we determine the price at this point, we call the market clearing price. And the logic of the argument goes like this. The price is either at the market clearing price, at which quantity demand and quantity supply are the same, or it's above the market clearing price, at which the quantity supplied would exceed the quantity demanded, or it's below the market clearing price, at which the quantity demanded would exceed the quantity supplied. Those are the only three options. All we have to do then to show that the price of the good is at the market clearing price is to show that it can neither be above nor below. Well, what if the price were above the market clearing price? If the price were above the market clearing price, then there would be sellers in the market who did not have their preferences satisfied. It would be excess supply, right? If, say, the price were $15,000, then all three sellers would want to sell. Only one would be able to make a sale. Let's say it was Z. And so the preferences of X and Y would not be satisfied. Now, clearly, that's unsatisfactory, right? In other words, action is always striving to attain preferences, not to have them thwarted or not attained. And so sellers X and Y will not sit still and permit this situation to proceed. They'll preempt it, right? In other words, they'll lower their asking price in order to have their preferences satisfied. seller Y will step in and offer to sell at 13. And as soon as seller Y does that, then seller Z becomes a sub-marginal seller. He's cut out of the market. And buyer B comes in. And at that point, then, we have everyone's preferences satisfied. Buyer A gets to buy, he wants to. Buyer B gets to buy, he wants to. Buyer C doesn't buy because he doesn't want to. Seller X sells because he wants to. Y sells because he wants to. Z refuses to sell, but that's what he wants to do. If the price were below the market clearing price, we have excess demand. If we have excess demand, then there are buyers in the market who do not have their preferences satisfied. Right? We have the low price. Every buyer wants to buy. Only one seller is selling. Let's say buyer C gets the car at $11,000. But again, buyer A and buyer B will not. They want to trade, right? They're not going to sit still and permit C to preempt them. They'll raise their bid price. Why will they do this? Because that's what they prefer. Right? It'd be great for buyer B to get the car at 11, but you know he's willing to pay 13. And so in order to preempt C from getting the car, he'll bid the price up. Once he does that, then the market clears. And when the market clears, all of the traders have their preferences satisfied. That's why the market clearing price dominates, precisely because it satisfies the general criterion of action, which is action satisfies our preferences. Now, let me just make one final concluding remark. These prices, then, are the basis for entrepreneurial appraisement, for engaging in economic calculation. And I've just given suggestions about this, as I mentioned, because Professor Salerno will cover this today in his lecture on economic calculation. So I'll stop here. Thank you.